The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes, and today I'm here with a very special guest, an actual Predator drone. Unfortunately, the Predator in question has had a bit too much to drink. Yes, my guest today is the famous @DrunkenPredator, Twitter phenom, essayist, and student of all things unmanned aerial vehicles. We don't normally interview inanimate objects on the Lawfare podcast, but the Drunken Predator is a most unusual robot. For those of you who don't know him, Drunken Predator has been tweeting anonymously for some time now. He also blogs occasionally over at Gunpowder and Lead, and he recently wrote an essay in Foreign Policy magazine about misconceptions in the human population about drones. Links to his work appear on Lawfare in the post associated with this podcast. He flew into Brookings's conference room recently for a chat about his drinking habits, UAVs, and his peculiar career in public life. So tell me, sir, why do you drink?
I drink because you humans insist on blaming me for all of the perceived negative developments in warfare and surveillance and technology that you use to accomplish your goals throughout the world, both abroad in theaters of war, whether declared or undeclared, and here at home. There are a lot of misconceptions that are very difficult to refute when you're busy flying around over various war zones. Key among them, first being that I'm somehow different from any other weapon that's ever been invented. The idea that just because I don't have a human pilot riding along on board with me, that now I have ushered in an era of cost-free, risk-free warfare is absurd. History is full of trying to increase the distance between the warfighter, which I prefer not to call him my human pilot. I think of him more as a co-pilot. But history is full of trying to separate the person doing the killing from the act of killing itself. I'm simply one more extension of that. The drone, and I use the term drone because that's simply the common parlance at this point, and using anything else really confuses the matter, even though I have some problems with the term. The drone is simply another step from the cruise missile, which is another step from the smart bomb, which is another step dating all the way back to the bow and arrow. Humans don't like to be close to killing, and blaming me for the consequences of the decision to use force doesn't make any more sense than blaming the arrow rather than the archer.
Now, you would concede, I assume, that you are in some sense novel, that there is something new about you. In what sense are you no different from any technology that's preceded you, and in what sense are you different?
Nothing on board my airframe is radically new. Drones, remotely piloted aircraft used for military purposes, have functionally been around since the 1970s. The Israeli Air Force had its own unmanned aircraft squadron in the 70s. The technology aboard me is not fundamentally new. What's new, and what I would grant is a change in the use of force, is the integration of these technologies to combine a surveillance and reconnaissance platform with a prompt strike platform that has a very long, what's called loiter time. In the past, if you wanted to watch a target very closely, learn about it, and then track your rounds it move, and then make the decision to attack it, you might need two or three different, you might need a spy satellite, working with someone on the ground, perhaps working with a jet fighter nearby, with a bomb on board the jet fighter. And what I and other drones create is the ability to, for a relatively low cost, compared to all of those other systems together, to perform that function on one platform. And I think that a lot of the things that make me drink, that make me upset about where how humanity views us, comes from the conflation of the concept of broad global ongoing war with the tools used to wage it. I'm very good at the tasks that are necessary to go after people in places like Yemen or Pakistan or Somalia. I can hang out over an area for relatively low cost. I can hit something if I need to. I'm fairly unobtrusive, although somebody in the Northwest Frontier Provinces might disagree with that. I give unprecedented situational awareness to people who are on the other side of the world. People tend to confuse, I think people tend to assign me a certain agency, saying that, you know, because I'm there, that's why we're simply relying on me because I can do all of these things. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it, with the broader question of, why are we in all these places in the first place? Why are we using force in all these different places in the first place? I don't make that decision. I happen to be very good at the kind of work that's needed there, but it ends up being laid on my wings more than I prefer.
So one thing that makes you very different from other weapon systems, and for that matter, other UAVs, is that you have a Twitter feed and that you write stuff. And I'm interested in how a Predator, with drink or without, came to be a Twitter phenom, you know, with quite a following, actually, and writing articles in Foreign Policy magazine and blogging occasionally. So tell us your story. You're kind of a predator on a mission, but it's not a mission. It's an educational mission. How did it happen?
Ben, you try watching the same roadway, the same guy digging for 24 hours at a stretch. You get bored and you have a lot of satellite bandwidth that you can use to share your thoughts with the world that's not doing anything else. So Twitter was a really good outlet for when I was particularly bored and on an orbit that really had nothing going on, but somebody just wanted a particular area watched. And you know, I think initially the stuff that I posted was the kind of jokes you would assume somebody as bored as I was would make, like assigning a follow Friday to a truck that I happened to be following. But as it progressed, I think jokes about my daily life moved to address some of the broader misconceptions about me and about my other aerial or ground-based robotic cousins, because they're tough to get away from, even on Twitter. A couple of blogs and media outlets and such, yourself included, have been kind enough to listen to the not as to the more serious stuff that I've had to say, rather than just the silly jokes about, you know, where I woke up on Saturday morning.
And so let's talk about some of your cousins. We have an ongoing FAA process for all sorts of unleashings of domestic UAVs of one sort or another. Where do you see this going? I assume you're not going to be flying around domestically, but there's a lot of possibilities for all sorts of uses of technologies not entirely unlike you for various domestic purposes. How do you see it playing out, and over what time frame?
Well, some of my cousins actually already are, and the Customs and Border Protection has a couple of us flying up along the southern border and also along the northern border, unarmed, but the same airframe as me, a General Atomic Spreader B, otherwise known as an MQ-9 Reaper. But that, to me, is the exception that proves the rule. The vast majority of the drones that the recent congressional legislation authorized to be used within the National Airspace System are very small and would be very unfamiliar to people whose only experience with drones were with folks like me. One of the things that concerns me is that, and I've written about this a couple of times, that the folks who are really opposed to my role in what has been called by some targeted killings overseas, they've kind of conflated that with the fact that, you know, drones are now being authorized for use in the National Airspace System here at home. But conversely, the folks who are really, and the folks who are upset about that because of a perceived surveillance culture will point to my role abroad and say, well, you know, now you're bringing this killing machine home. And it's really not the case. The vast majority of the UAVs, of the surveillance platforms that are going to be authorized within American airspace at home, aren't going to look very different from the little model airplanes that people have been flying in this country for 50, 60 years. The difference is that they're going to have a capacity to make some flight decisions on their own. They're going to be able to fly waypoints, say, okay, I want you to go to point A, B, C, and D, and then come home. I think that the big challenge that the legal community is going to have to deal with over the next 10 to 15 years will be on the public side, on government use of drones. If you look at what, on the private sector side, folks like Chris Anderson, who is one of the founders of Wired, and a lot of his colleagues are avid drone hobbyists who've been building their own backyard aircraft that would be the envy of a lot of military or government agencies across the world. I think what we'll probably see in the next 10 to 15 years is not the proliferation of drones from a law enforcement perspective at home. I actually don't think that that's going to forgive the term, off the ground as quickly. You really see the proliferation in private sector applications. Real estate agents are already getting themselves in hot water with the FAA using drones to take aerial photography of property. The World Wildlife Foundation is using drones in Nepal to look out for poachers that are a threat to endangered species there. There are organizations in Indonesia that are counting orangutan populations in the forest using drones. And, you know, in the United States, I think you can expect to see in the next 10 or 15 years drones as traffic helicopters, especially with the weather that we've been having over in the United States over the last couple of years with climate change. You'll be seeing farmers use them for drought mapping and for crop imaging. And I think there's a lot of areas that you'll see domestic drone use that people don't necessarily expect. The U.S. Postal Service is facing a huge budget shortfall right now, and with current technology available for remotely for drones, it really wouldn't be all that difficult to rig up relatively small drones that would take the place of a lot of rural postal routes.
They'd have to have quite a payload, though.
They would, but when you look at the enthusiasm assigned a small drone helicopter that would deliver tacos, the Taco Copter, which was not an actual business as of yet, but has buzz that would be the envy of a lot of startups in Silicon Valley, forgive the term, the sky is sort of the limit for these things domestically. I think the other question that doesn't get much addressed is that there is lot of concern over how law enforcement would use these to conduct surveillance, to execute search warrants. But when you have widespread civilian use of these, I don't think many people have asked the question of what kind of data will these civilian drones be collecting that will then be at the disposal of law enforcement, either with a search warrant or without. I mean, look at how easy it is for a police department to use your cell phone.
Right. I mean, at least without a change in law, the assumption would be if somebody collects it and it's relevant to a legitimate investigation, it can be subpoenaed. So what about cargo and passenger aviation? I mean, you have very large industry of moving people and goods around the country. The more you watch technology like you, the less clear it becomes, at least to me, why the pilots of those jets need to be on board the jets at all. Why, at least as an initial matter, a company like FedEx or UPS couldn't do itself a world of good with its pilot unions by simply not having pilots. And in the long run, I suppose you could say the same thing about United Airlines. Is there any particular reason why cargo and passenger aviation should involve humans in the plane?
It's clearly, for now, a question of human comfort. Human comfort both on the ground and in the air. I think that if you really disagree with the notion of a computer or a satellite link being primarily in control of the aircraft that you're riding in, then you shouldn't get on any jetliner that's been produced in the last 25 or 30 years, because the vast majority of the flight activities on board, especially, say, a transatlantic flight, are being performed by computer, and the pilots are simply there in an oversight role. They can pretty much take off and land themselves and fly themselves. But there is a human, there's a deep-seated human discomfort for now with the notion of the pilot not being on board the aircraft.
And what about in your case, when I think I read somewhere that there were the vast majority of crashes of Predators were the result of pilot error on takeoff and landing, and the result was that they had actually removed human pilots from the loop of the takeoffs and landing, which had been sort of the only part that they'd been running. Is that right? I mean, sort of what's the history?
I think you're referring to the Army variant of my airframe versus the Air Force variant of my airframe, where they had the an auto land and an auto takeoff feature. As with manned aircraft, the vast majority of incidents happen on takeoff and landing. But as you look at our flight record, the flight record of drones, the more activities you let the computer, quote, artificial intelligence perform, the safer it ends up looking. The programming that goes into takeoff, landing, flight operations, whatever you want the aircraft to perform, is the sum of all of the experience of human pilots that you can put into that system. Most human pilots are not Sully. I think you will find, over the next 10 to 15 years, a growing acceptance of remotely piloted or robotic aerial platforms performing roles that currently have manned aircraft in place. I think cargo is, you rightly point out, is probably going to be one of the first ones that is really noticeable. Traffic helicopters, for example, is probably going to be another significant one. There are so rarely unusual events in those tasks. The routes are fixed. The waypoints that you want to hit, whether it's the intersection of I-95 and 495 out on the Beltway, there is so rarely something unusual that you would require an onboard human pilot for those tasks that I think aerial robotics are very well suited for them. I think commercial air travel is probably going to be one of the last ones that will go.
But for reasons of human comfort, not for reasons of technological capability.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. And the thing is that drones, especially domestically, are going to have to do the same thing that humans do flying aircraft, but in an order of magnitude more safely. I think I could make a pretty convincing argument that humans don't belong in the cockpit if I simply relied on the aviation safety record of general aviation in this country. If you look at Cessnas and the little experimental aircraft, those things have a tragic safety record because they're simply small aircraft with human pilots on board flying in adverse conditions a lot of the time, and you know, without a lot of autopilot or the safety and training mechanisms that you have to support a large commercial airliner. So drones will have to be much, much safer even than humans are today in order to gain acceptance, especially domestically, especially in civilian roles.
And so one of the things I've been thinking about very small drones recently for reasons related to our coming Lawfare drone smackdown. And I'm kind of amazed by the capability and power of the little Parrot drone, which, you know, you can buy for $300 at Brookstone and fly over your neighbor's house, and it has a pretty good camera. What do you see as the short-term, medium-term capability of very inexpensive personal drones looking like? I mean, is this something that, you know, just as it was unimaginable 20 years ago that we were all going to be walking around with little communications devices, that there's going to be a sort of personal robotics revolution that we're all going to be kind of using these things in ways that we really could never have imagined only recently? Or is this going to be more in the range of things that large corporations do or media organizations do, people who have need to fly around taking pictures of things?
I think that you'll probably see them in roles you wouldn't have expected, but I doubt that personal robotics, at least from, you know, like a drone, are going to be very commonplace for everyday people, the way the cell phone is now commonplace for everyday people. I think that it is probably more, it will likely be more in line with your first scenario, in which large, even medium-sized corporations or government agencies or, you know, even nonprofit organizations will be using drones to perform very specific tasks, or, you know, I simply use the term aerial robotics. But I don't think it will be something that will pervade everybody's life. I do think you may see them doing things you wouldn't expect. Right now, if a hurricane takes out a certain area in, you know, say in the southeast, and they lose their cell phone towers, you may have Verizon or Sprint pack up a couple of mobile cell sites in the back of a trailer and send them down there. There is technology under discussion now and in negotiation with the FCC that would allow that same cell technology to be put aboard an aerial platform, whether it's a drone or whether it's an aerostat or something like that. I think that I don't think you will see aerial robotics going far outside of the roles that previous manned platforms, whether it's helicopters or fixed-wing aircraft, have performed, but I think you may see a lot more of them. I think, you know, right now, if the local TV news station can afford one news helicopter, they may now be able to afford, 10 drones. And so you may suddenly see a lot more aerial photography of news scenes. And suddenly they don't have to send out a crew anymore. They can simply backhaul it either up to a satellite or over a radio network. What we saw is sort of the TV revolution in media in the 60s and 70s with way more local news, with television cameras being sort of everywhere, satellite trucks, that kind of thing. I think you may now start seeing that with drones. I think that would probably be perhaps the most visible thing. If humans are driving up the highway and they see a couple of news helicopters hovering over a particular area, you go, oh, well, I'll probably see that on the evening news tonight. I know something big is happening there. I think you may not see that 10 to 15 years from now because you may have five or six different sites like that with a couple of drones over them.
Mr. Predator, thank you very much for coming in. Go easy on the booze.
Been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, a project of the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.